This is the DTV Digest, the podcast that brings you news and reviews of films which didn't make it to the cinema. And now, here's your host, Mike Parkin.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the DTV Digest, the podcast which brings you reviews of films which didn't make it to the cinema and instead went straight to Blu-ray, DVD, and streaming media. I'm your host, Mike Parkin, and joining me this week are Richard Hawes.
Hello, everybody.
And Will Bentley.
Hello.
And this week, this is our Euro Serial Killer episode, as our three main reviews are all set in the wilds of Europe. Let's crack on. Our first review, then, is Twin Murders, Silence in the City. 20 years after a serial killer was convicted for a number of murders involving twins, a copycat starts to commit identical murders down to the very last detail. The original detective on the case has just returned to active duty after the death of his pregnant wife and must work with his new female boss to untangle the intricate deadly web descending on the town. So this one is set in the sort of Basque region on the Spanish side. Very interesting sort of locale to set this. Lots of sort of, you know, small alleyways and big churches and that sort of thing going on. And I think of the three films we're discussing tonight, it has probably the most cartoonish villain. Yeah. I'll chuck this over to you, Will, to begin with.
Yeah, I mean, it's really the... If I'm honest, I thought that the methodology was like really elaborate. Like, I mean, it's almost manga. It's so over the top. But I mean, it's early on in the film, it makes for quite kind of beautiful scene setting. You know, the sort of little vignettes that are created with the twin bodies. You know, it's that usual sort of. It's obviously a very artistic, very kind of aesthetic serial murderer, you know. And you're obviously, you know, it's like, what is motivating this tortured genius with this, you know, with all this beautiful, elaborate, you know, sadistic portraiture? But you know, as it kind of goes on, the reality is, it's just like, why go to all that effort? I don't really understand. It does look very nice and very artistic, coupled with the Basque Country's stunning architecture as well as a backdrop.
Yeah, they get a lot of mileage out of that church, don't they? The cathedral, you know.
The set piece set around
that is very, very good. Rich, what are your initial thoughts on this?
I found it very confusing. It's adapted from a novel, and I think that really comes across. Because they've tried to cram in a lot of plots and subplots, which really take the focus off the main story. And I just found it really hard to follow what on earth was going on in terms of, is it a copycat? Was the original guy, who was convicted, was he actually guilty or innocent? Or what's going on with his partner and her brother and the drugs and what else was there? He's called Kraken, apparently.
For reason.
And his identity his identity is revealed, which is like a big deal, but it's never explained why. So I didn't really get whether he was like an undercover cop or something. And it doesn't get that to me. It didn't feel like it went anywhere. He's got the opening scene of the movie is him meeting a woman who will later turn out to be his superior. At the unit where he works, and they both introduce each other with introduce themselves with fake names, which is kind of a theme, I guess, that runs through the film about, you know, people misrepresenting themselves and stuff. So she's kind of tied to the killer without wanting to give anything away too much, but there's a link there. Him and her get involved. There's just way too much going on. And I just didn't. It kind of ended the movie, and I don't really know what was what. I kind of lost my train of thought. I only watched it two nights ago, and I can't.
Did you want them to get together or not?
I didn't really think about it too much, to be honest. It was a bit strange, their coupling scene and everything. It's called the Silence of the White City is the translation, and Netflix, in their acquisition, have slapped Twin Murders on as a prefix to, you know, make it a bit more marketable.
It's a murder mystery.
The title even sounds like The Silence of the Lambs, and all his scenes where he goes to visit the guy, the convict in prison, they're just totally Hannibal Lecter-ish of the guy. And he's got, that's the other thing, he's got a twin brother. There's a whole thing going on with him. There's just too much going on. I felt it was really unclear, although it, you know, it's very handsomely shot and everything. It just lost me because of that, and the story was just not clear. So it was a big problem for me.
Yeah, I kind of agree. There's certain plot points which don't seem to sort of really go anywhere. The whole thing, what happened to his ex-wife, his wife.
That's the other thing. That's another one.
that's obviously a big deal. The whole thing with his name, Kraken, you know, why he was called this, you know, why it seems to have such resonance among people, especially the public, you know, which we're never sort of privy to at all. It is a very sort of strange situation.
I'm sure in the novel it's, you know, makes sure much more sense.
Yeah, exactly.
But I think it's quite telling that on Internet Movie Database, the synopsis for the film is a cop returns to the job.
Yeah.
A serial killer too returns to the job.
At least
it's like they haven't made any effort to actually explain anything about it.
Into introducing the film, yeah, exactly. Jesus.
Oh, no, it's shocking. I read that IMDb thing, and it's like it looks like it's been done with Google Translate.
there's a whole host of characters who could be the villain, even though the villain is actually or seems to be unveiled quite early on in the film. You know, it's quite unusual to have that card played so early. But then it just sort of adds to the sort of uneasiness, you know, because this character's sort of interacting with everyone, you know, as to how things are going to sort of turn out. But I found his method of killing people to be just so contrived.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's the most comic book sort of villainy that we've got. I mean, one of the other films we're talking about later uses, you know, at least it has some sort of historical context, you know, elaborate sort of scheme that goes on in that film. But, this just is like, well, yeah, I'm going to sort of fill them up with bees.
The bees. Yeah,
like, why go to all that effort? Do you know what I mean?
Especially when he doesn't seem to have any connection to bees at all. You know, the other characters have got connection to bees, but, you know, this particular one doesn't seem to. It's just
pants. It's like, you know, the way, I don't want to give too much away about the exact methodology about the bees, but, you know, like, as frightening as it is, I would think that you'd have a go at, you know,
eating them, chewing them up.
Yeah, basically, yeah, that. That. You'd chew them up. Surely you would, wouldn't you? I mean, you've got nothing to lose.
Exactly, yeah. It is a weird situation. I mean, you know, it looks queasy, that's for sure. You know, it's going to sort of put the audience on edge, you know, watching it. It sort of pushes it more into sort of Saw territory more than anything else, doesn't it, I think?
Yeah.
But anyway. So, I mean, it was an enjoyable film. You know, it's never dull, that's for sure. Although at times we're left sort of scratching our heads as to what is actually going on and why. It's very well shot, as we've discussed. It just seems a bit too, you know, sort of pulpy paperback novel, really. It feels like a 90s thriller more than anything else. What do you reckon?
Absolutely. Yeah, I do. I mean, I think it was I'd say that it was shot and written like that, and it was also by someone who really loved that kind of, you know, those kind of really largely drawn vignettes, and you know, the bees, and you know, the kind of the sort of posing, artful posing of the corpses in the first part of the film, and overly convoluted, sort of unresolved, unrequited backstories that, you know, they're elliptical, and that kind of seems mysterious, but actually it's just frustrating and makes you think that they never got around to finishing it properly.
Yes, that's right. okay, so scores on the doors for this one?
Six.
Six from Will, Rich?
I'm going to be quite cruel on this one. I'm going to go a four.
Oh, ooh. That's low. Well, I'm going to split the difference between you. I'm going to go for a five on this. So a 4, 5 and a 6 for Twin Murders, Silence in the City. Our next review is To the Wire. A reclusive detective comes to realise that a series of deaths are in fact murders which have been staged to look like suicides. However, she can only find one person in her division which will accept her theory, a detective who has recently moved from the country. Together they soon come to realise that the murders have been committed by the same person. But who? So, Rich, this is set in Budapest in Hungary.
Mm-hmm.
And it has a really striking way of sort of segueing between scenes with this amazing sort of photography of like landscapes, but turned upside down.
Yeah.
And I just thought it was really, really cool because it made like the city look like a spaceship or something, you know, all this sort of stuff. It was, you know, and quite unsettling as well, as you're trying to sort of like, you know, your mind's trying to sort of flip the image back over. I thought it was really striking, quite original. The story itself, it's like a really, really serious version of the series Monk that Tony Shalhoub did, where we've got this detective who, since the suicide of her husband, has been basically a recluse, even at work, where she, you know, her office is in the basement. She just looks at the photographs that people send her, and she does her deductions from that. And then, shortly after making this claim that suicides have been are actually murders in these three cases, she's basically dragged out of her comfort zone by her new partner, this sort of country bumpkin cop, who, basically slowly sort of draws her out of her shell. And it's a really compelling film, I've thought. What are your thoughts, Rich?
Well, I thought it was quite pretentious with its very slow, drawn-out opening of introducing the characters and the sort of the music choices and all the upside down shots.
I agree with you on that point. It took a while to settle in because it was showing us all these different images from the first set of murders and things like that. It was all over the place to begin with.
Yeah, the original title was X, or X the Exploited, which they've renamed as To the Wire. Although I don't quite get the meaning of the To the Wire.
Nope.
Title either.
Nope.
But X is quite an oblique title, and it kind of fits it. I mean, it has a relevance to an aspect of the story. You get the
one of the characters,
sort of anarchic, yeah, or punk character. I think they actually play some exploited band, punk band music, or at least another punk band's music during the film. Musical choices are quite significant in the film, so that's quite interesting. So I found it all a bit pretentious. There's the looks really good. The character, the main character, is a very damaged individual. As you've said, she's grieving and hasn't really, you know, got over the death of her husband. She's got a very, very strained relationship with her daughter. She's sort of become a joke at work because her and her husband were both very feted detectives, very respected, but she suffers these panic attacks now, and she's not very reliable. And there's a key point in the movie where they're sort of chasing after one of the bad guys, and she's just completely, you know, she crumbles. She's like unable to hold the gun. And she's sort of, she becomes a liability, basically, and that's how they see her. So her character takes an interesting journey, and the film itself does too, because it's kind of does things. It does something similar to Twin Murders, where it starts to show its hand a lot earlier than you would expect, but instead of sort of resolving anything, that actually just leads to more questions, and those questions aren't fully resolved by the end of the film. There's you have to put a lot of work in yourself and think things through. At the end, there's kind of a leap forward in time, and you have to remember back some of the events that have happened. I mean, at the start of the film, we get, as you were saying, all these scenes of, you know, people dying, and everyone thinks that they are not suicides, they are accidents and such. But she sees the connection. And we said, so all these lengthy scenes at the opening do pay off because you revisit those moments and for the various characters. And it's a really interesting idea, and the theme as it plays out is quite good. But yeah, it dragged a bit too much for me, to be honest.
It is a slow film, that's for sure, you know, and it doesn't do itself any favours in that regard. But I really like this one. I like watching the main character, you know, develop, you know, slowly sort of like unfurling. You know, it's very apparent she's a very good detective, you know, and is able to sort of deduce. She's brought to this scene where someone's supposedly hanged themselves, and was able to deduce that she wouldn't have been tall enough to, you know, to do it, basically, to stand on the chair.
Yeah, that's a good
and, you know, tie the rope and everything.
I like the bit where the compression of the cushion, and she's like, well, that adds another 3 inches something.
Because you just sort of stood on, you know, it's not a case of just like having the cushion or the chair. You know, if you stand on it, that's going to depress. So there's another sort of 4 centimeters or something, which is all very good. So I was really interested in all of that, and the stuff with the daughter, it just seemed like, you know, misery upon misery, you know, as if she needed any more issues to worry about, you know, her daughter's been bullied at school and things like that, and of course the authorities not doing anything about it. It goes on.
And that kind of comes into its own at the end, where she kind of. Without, I don't really want to spoil anything, but, you know, her priorities change at the end of, I mean, all through the whole story, you know, she's very much a woman who can't let go.
Yeah.
And at the end, you know, she's a bit more flexible, let's say.
Yeah, I think there's at one point, you know, so one of the bad guys sort of showboats to her, you know, monologues at her about, you don't have a choice in the matter, you know, you just a peon, basically, you know, you know, what you do doesn't really matter in the great scheme of things. And she sort of like bucks against that up to a point, and then realise, you know, at the end of the film, it's like, okay, you know, you got to get your priorities right. At the end of the day, nothing's going to change. You know, look after the ones you can, sort of thing, which I thought was sort of very interesting and quite pragmatic sort of ending to the film. But yeah, no, I thought it was pretty decent. Obviously, the thing about the husband as well, you know, that was obviously going to go the way it went. But yeah. I enjoyed this one probably a bit more than the other one. It felt a bit more realistic, you know, not so comic booky, and not so pulpy in what it was doing. So I'm going to give this one a 7 out of 10.
I'm going to go for a 6 out of 10 this time.
A bit more respectable, yes. So this one is on Amazon Prime. You can find it under the title To The Wire. That's a 6 and a 7 from Mike and Rich. Our next review is The Plagues of Breslau. A serial killer is using a series of historical plagues that were beset on the ancient town of Breslau in a seemingly random set of victims. A grieving detective must put aside her personal issues to help a profiler in determining the truth. So it's a bit of a theme this week, guys, of sort of emotionally damaged people having to deal with serial killers.
Yes.
Deep in the heart of Europe, basically. So this one is set in Poland, and we have a very acerbic detective, doesn't give a shit about any, upsetting the public one way or another, as we see a lot, just very foul-mouthed, sort of very prickly sort of character. And she's sort of matched in a way by this profiler who's sent in from sort of the bigger city to help out, who just seems to be as gruff and sort of put upon as she is. And the sort of the murders in this one sort of take a more sort of baroque twist. The first one is someone who's been sewn inside the leather hide of a cow and suffocated and been branded as the later victims are. But, there is a historical context to what's going on and things are linked, even though it's not particularly clear up front. Will, how do you find this one?
It was very interesting. I've not actually watched that many Polish dramas, let alone Polish crime dramas. So seeing how it's done, from that perspective. I mean, there's more and more stuff on Netflix, and my partner's certainly getting into the Euro crime stuff. And, I'm going to personally be looking it out, because some of the stuff that I've watched just on my own time and also, for the show, I've been impressed. And this is impressive. It's very interesting. The theme is not that dissimilar, like you said, sort of wounded, damaged detectives, kooky, off-kilter profilers, alarming, baroque, elaborate crime scenes, and killers that kind of develop an obsession with the detective hunting them. It's pretty much standard, but seeing it done in the Polish way is, to be honest, it's gritty as hell. The characters are gritty as hell. This pair were very convincing to me as coppers. They just looked worn out. It's so funny, because I was looking at their kind of publicity shots on IMDb and then comparing it to, what I've just watched very recently on this film, and they look like career coppers. They look lived in.
Yeah.
And tough. And they look as though they're a day away from being busted back to uniform and giving out parking tickets. And they'd be completely believable.
Yeah, definitely.
And it was just an interesting. And I was noticing a few different things actually, just about the scene setting and just the cinematography and camera work. And it was just very interesting seeing, like, what was the first film, the
Twin
Plagues,
Murders.
Twin Murders, the Silence of the White City.
Yeah.
Was quite lonely in terms of it was the two protagonists most of the time.
Hmm.
Whereas in this, the two heroines have got this kind of, as the film goes on, have got like a sort of supporting cast of, the team,
investigation team,
and, the sort of, these kind of, they just acquire this kind of group of grizzled, hard-boiled Polish coppers. And there's one sequence where they're running around watching CCTV for the murder that was committed in the station.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's just odd, because there's like a whole gang of them, sort of walking around, doing this job, and it's just sort of really quite alarming when you're so used to the kind of the loneliness of the detective or the duo doing stuff, and all of a sudden you've got this whole backdrop, this whole kind of cast.
But something my wife notice in the Twin Cities film is how empty the city was, apart from those, that main celebration scene. You know, it is sort of a minimal cast, even, you know, in this big sort of city sort of thing. And the previous one, To the Wire, you know, the character was intentionally sort of withdrawn from people, so, you know, she'd pushed everyone away to you know, further than arm's length. Whereas this one, it is, as you say, you know, there is a bona fide team sort of working together, which is
more, yeah. It's more realistic, and it's also it just makes for a different film. It's crowded. There's a claustrophobia about, you know, what they do. You know, they're constantly there. They're constantly sort of not just embattled by, you know, the sort of invisible killer and the pressure of trying to stop, you know, people dying or trying to put together clues, but just of constantly being under scrutiny and constantly having to kind of work within this, you know, other people's attitudes and, you know, comments and criticisms of them. But, you know, I thought it was quite, I enjoyed it. I enjoyed their characters as well. They were just hard boiled.
Yeah.
And just tough as guts, really. I liked them. But it is, you know, it's like, I don't know. I mean, I quite enjoy and I don't mind yet another serial killer with a taste for, you know, theatrical presentation. You know, but this was somewhere between, again, Hannibal Lecter and, like, The Name of the Rose.
The person behind this has gone sort of medieval on their ass, basically. Gave it a bit more refreshing and less convoluted than, you know, what we saw in Twin Murders, that's for sure. Rich, your thoughts on this?
Out of the three movies, this was my favorite by quite a long way. The director, Patrick Wega, is probably my favourite Polish filmmaker, even though, it's an interesting case. He's a very successful, very commercial filmmaker, but he usually makes quite grotesque and sensational portraits of his country. You know, horrible people doing horrible things. You know, it just makes Poland look really bad in a number of aspects. So he's covered, he's done a lot of gangster stuff and the police. And Wales, the pharmaceuticals, cosmetics industries, stuff. That film, Botox, is, I think, recently added to Prime. That's worth a look as well. But, you know, really horrible stuff happening. We watched one of his films previously, one of the Pitbull films, think. And he usually has big ensembles of, you know, lots of different characters and stuff. And this was much more focused. We're spending our time with this one particular character for the majority of the time, played by, what was her character name? Helena, played by Małgorzata Kozuchowska. But she's barely recognizable. I mean, I've seen her in lots of different stuff. I had to question whether it was her or not because she looks so different. And Wega does this quite often. He takes these really glamorous, popular actresses and does kind of a Nicole Kidman destroyer kind of thing with them and just completely changes them. So Helena's got this really unusual, you know, shaved side on her head, which is quite distinctive. You know, we first meet her sitting in the car, she's filmed from the opposite side and she looks quite sensible. And then you switch it round and she just looks like completely deranged or something.
Because it's a haircut for a woman kind of 10 years younger than the woman she appears to be in this film.
And she's also on the edge, you know, she's just a mess. I mean, we see her breaking down when she's alone, but when she's out doing a job amongst other people, she's as hard as nails. So there's a lot quite interesting going on there. And as you guys have already observed, sort of ties in with the themes that we've already seen in To the Wire. But the film itself, apart from that, I just think it's really well executed, very, very fast paced, unlike the previous two films. It's, you know, brisk. It's about an hour and a half. It gets on with it. There's some surprising reveals earlier than you would expect. The ending is quite playful because a bit like in it jumps ahead a bit. I think I might have been referring to another film, but in this one I think it jumps ahead and then sort of fills you in.
You get sort of to the end and then the sort of reveal, there's a big reveal, then you sort of find out how they got to that that point.
Yeah. I can't remember if they did the same thing into The Wire, but because the themes tie in with the film, so they're so similar in certain regards. It's easy to get confused. But this one is much more mainstream.
Yeah, it's a familiar trope of things like heist movies and things. You know, where you've been sold one direction, and then they suddenly go another direction. You go, well, how did they get there? And then they sort of fill in afterwards how they got there, which is all really cool. So yeah, I really love the ending. I must admit, you know, that moment of catharsis for the character at the end, I thought was really cool, regardless of the sort of the morality of it.
Did you find it a bit like you feel like you're watching it and you're like, hang on a minute, it wasn't Saw like 20 years ago? Hmm. I mean, not Saw. I mean, Saw is an influence on this as well, but Seven specifically, the whole serial killer with a gimmick. There was a whole slew of Seven knockoffs, and it's like many years later this has kind of come along but it feels like it fits in with those. Not that that's a bad thing, I don't mind it, but it felt like it was revisiting quite dated conventions, but you know, wasn't the worst for it. I mean, I thought the big set pieces with the horses and the theater and everything were great.
Really good.
Very well done. You know, clearly, I mean, he works on much lower budgets than what Hollywood would have. Mm-hmm. And even this is, you know, clearly, if you look aesthetically on it, like Twin Murders seems to have had a much bigger budget. But, you know, the city shots, the cityscape shots and everything look great. The cast is great. The prosthetics are really, really good. And the visual effects. I thought it was great. There's some weird moments of dark humour, of like having selfies with corpses and stuff, which seem a bit out of place.
It's really weird. It's that one character keeps taking photos, and I'm thinking, he doesn't seem to know how his phone works. It was really, really bizarre the way he was taking photographs.
But that's the kind of thing Vega does more often in his other films. This one is kind of pushing away some of that. Some of those kind of things, but he can't help himself in a couple of the scenes to just sort of go a bit
quirky.
Yeah, a bit sort of quirky, a bit tasteless, you could say, in a couple of things.
And I have to say with this as well that the prosthetics are some of the best you're likely to see, and there's a particular autopsy scene at the beginning which is just gruesome, you know, because it looks so real. What they're actually sort of doing, it's pretty gross. So be warned on that point. If you're a bit squeamish, you might want to give this a bit of a berth. If not, it's as you've heard from us, we highly recommend it. In fact, we're going to score it, Rich.
I'm going to score it 8 out of 10.
Mm-hmm. Will?
I can't fault it. I'd agree. I'd go along with that.
Yeah, both me and my wife really enjoyed this one. So, yeah, 3/8 for The Plagues of Breslau. Our short shot this week is Lost Souls, a Mortal Kombat short film. In this one, we have Liu Kang going into a bar, looks like in Mexico or somewhere, punching out the bartender, who then turns into a myriad of Mortal Kombat characters for Liu Kang to fight. And that's basically all we get in this one, guys, isn't it? It's just one long fight scene in a bar, which is a bit of a shame. We get the usual sort of characters like Kano and Sonya Blade and Johnny Cage turning up. They basically get a few punches each, and then they disappear and get replaced by somebody else. I couldn't really sort of see the point of this. Can you, Rich? There wasn't much of a sort of narrative throughput on this one.
No, it's got very little exposition, and I think as someone who has only the barest knowledge of the Mortal Kombat universe, you know, I don't take much of it, much from it in that sense. I mean, the characters aren't introduced, so it's more like when they appear. It's the recognition that's the big thing.
No, you don't.
I've got an idea.
So the set, the sort of man walks into a bar kind of concept of, you know, he's looking for someone or more than or people, and he ends up having this fight to try and get them back, but it's not really clear. It's like kind of like he's not going to get them back. So then it seems like basically it's more revenge. Mm-hmm. Than anything else, especially, you know, when it gets to the conclusion. But what I did think was really clever about it was that it was, we've seen quite a few short films that are fight scenes, but I love that this is a 10 minute fight scene, basically, like at least 8 minutes. But that the sort of, what do you call it? The shape shifting or regeneration or whatever, changing. Yeah. The identity of the opponent, having one opponent, but they keep changing their form, added something really interesting. I thought that was handled really well, and I thought I liked the choreography a lot. So I thought it was, yes, for what it was, I thought it was very well executed.
From a sort of a fight choreography standpoint, yes, it was very good, especially the knife fighting bit. I thought that was done particularly well with the strobe light and everything. The way he sort of drop the knife into the other hand and attack with that hand. I thought that was all really good. Can't fault that sort of side of it at all. It's just from, it's a fight scene, and on its own, I'm struggling to call it a short film as such.
Well, I think, we see lots of short films that are basically that. I mean, look at, we looked at the, oh, I can't remember. We've covered quite a few. I was going to say, what's his name? Night Shooters guy.
Oh, I know which one you mean now. Yeah. One Second Warehouse.
Yeah, which was quite long, but it was basically just one long fight scene.
Yeah, it is, but it had more context.
It did.
You understand a bit more what was going on. If you weren't, and I think, okay, you could say that this was made for Mortal Kombat fans, in which case, well done, because everyone's going to go, oh, that's that guy,
But even conceptually, it probably fits in somewhere in the overarching story of the games and the unit, the games or comics or whatever it all reaches into of, he's looking for someone. So therefore that must touch on another story that's happened somewhere else. It's a bit like some of these Star Wars films, they're most of which are really good. Or, the ones I've seen recently, where they don't give you a lot of exposition, but if you know what you're watching, then you're okay. You say, oh, okay, this is where Rogue One was. I recognize some of the sort of locations and stuff. But so I think you're right. I think this is very much a for the fans kind of movie, and for anyone who enjoys fight choreography would enjoy this a lot. I mean, it's not a narrative film.
No.
It's got a little... It's like a tiny bit, enough for me to get pretty much the same as what Richard got from it, which is he's clearly seeking to regain the souls of all those people that he's known and fought from whatever the shape-shifting person is that faces him as all of those people. And that, to say that there's only like 12 lines of dialogue in it, at the start of the there's hardly any exposition at the start before they start fighting, and then at the end, it's not a mean feat for someone to convey that in what is essentially a sort of 10-minute punch up.
I think they were partially successful in that because you guys picked up on more than I did, unfortunately.
Did you stick around for the post credits scene?
No, I never stick around for the bloody post credits scene. You know this.
Neither did I.
It's still not the norm for me. You know what I mean? Despite how many Marvel films I've seen over the years, it's still not the norm for me to sort of like wait until the final sort of second of the credits to roll by and then expect to see something else.
You haven't missed much. It's not particularly relevant. It's like an unusually comical scene sort of tacked on at the end where a drunk guy comes out of the bathroom, basically, at the toilet. And is a bit unaware or not quite bemused, but sort of is so drunk that he's not really understanding what's just happened in the bar, and there's this really sort of weird exchange. So I don't know why they did that, but
weird.
Anyway, so this is made by a guy called Kevin Burrill, and he's done loads of shorts and stunts and stuff for a whole load of stuff. He was the fight coordinator on Samurai Cop 2, apparently, amongst myriad other things. He played a character in that. But yeah, he's done tons of stuff. So this was the first time I'd seen any of his films. So I'm definitely curious to check out, you know, some of his other stuff, you know, see what kind of, how he does with storytelling, or maybe, you know, is it, you know, what the action is. But I think it's worth a look.
It certainly is. If you, just from a grassroots, sort of punch 'em up, sort of fight choreography point of view, I think it does a really good job. So, you know, even if you're not sort of overly familiar with Mortal Kombat, you're going to get something, if you like fight scenes, then this is a pretty decent one. And I have to say, this is a bit of a segue here, that the Liu Kang in this is a lot better than the Liu Kang that turns up in the recent animated film Mortal Kombat Legends Scorpion's Revenge, which I must admit, I really enjoyed watching. But Liu Kang's supposed to be the main good guy in that, and he's just as bland as fuck. He really is. He does nothing. What saves the film is the character of Johnny Cage, who's played by Joel McHale in this, of Community fame and many other things. And he gives him the right sort of laid-back, sort of like humour. You know, this is a guy no one takes seriously because he's a movie star. You know, nobody thinks he can actually fight. He thinks for most of the film that, it's a movie set. And he doesn't understand that he's actually in this sort of big tournament, you know, life or death, sort of save the universe kind of stuff. And Sonya Blade is played by Jennifer Carpenter from Dexter, among other things as well. So yeah, a good bit of voice acting going on. It is violent as hell and gory as hell as well. It does a great check of, when they do like their finishing moves and things, you get this sort of X-ray effect as you sort of see the bones crunching in the skull and other bits of bodies and things, which helps. The blood flows rather fluidly in this one. It's definitely worth a look. It's not for kids, that's for sure. I found it quite amusing. Liu Kang, ever since Robin Shu played him in the original Mortal Kombat film, he's just a wet fish, he really is. Anyway, that's enough of Mortal Kombat for the moment.
Well, I would say also it's worth checking out the Mortal Kombat web series from a few years ago that had Michael Jai White and stuff in it. I don't know if that's the one called Mortal Kombat Legacy, because that was like Casper Van Dien and stuff was in that. I'm not sure if that's the same thing, but
there was a good one which had Matt Mullins playing the Johnny Cage character.
Ah, that's it. Yeah, that is it. I've just found him and cast it. So it's there. So that was a series that had loads of. I mean, there was one or two episodes of that were animated as well. They're kind of mixing it up, but that had loads of cool. I mean, say Michael Jai White. I think who else was in that? Eric Jacobus, Mark Dacascos,
yes, that's right.
Dan Southworth, and Kari Hiroyuki Tagawa. So that's well worth seeking out if you're interested. That's a much better bet than this film.
If you're going specifically for Mortal Kombat, then yes. Yeah. So, you know, if you want a decent fight scene during your lunch hour, check out this one. You know, 10 minutes of a decent punch up. Our DTV throwback this week is Faults. A hard on his luck psychologist is asked to help a couple deprogram their daughter, who has gotten involved in a cult called Faults. Taking her to a motel room, he starts a 5-day program, but who is really in control? So this was my choice for the DTV throwback, a film I really enjoyed when I saw it last year, Rich. I was really glad to see it pop up on Prime. What do you make of it?
It's a film to ponder, isn't it? It's hard to explain because it starts out. I mean, it's very indie. That's the first thing to say. It's like a proper indie film. It's written and directed by Riley Stearns, who wrote the Jesse Eisenberg film, The Art of Self-Defense, which has recently been, I think it's come available on like Sky recently. But yeah, he made this one in 2014 with Leland Orser and Mary Elizabeth Winstead. She's obviously very well established, whatever. Leland Orser is very much a character actor. So you don't get to see him in lead roles. So this is a tremendously meaty role for him, and he does really well. We've also got it's a small cast, but we've also got Beth Grant in it there from Speed and various other things, and Lance Reddick, who is instantly recognisable from the John Wick films. But you know, Orser is playing this. You know, it's hard to, my head sort of goes around in it, because we first meet him in a restaurant. In what turns out to be a hotel restaurant, where he's trying to basically steal a meal. Scam, you know, badly try to scam a meal, and then it sort of escalates out of control and becomes really absurd with him, you know, sort of saying, yeah, "Well, I just want to catch." They're trying to, they're trying to throw him out, and he's like, "Well, I'm just going to keep eating. I'm going to have a bit more. Well, I'm just going to grab stuff." But it's like his petulant child kind of thing. And then it turns out, oh, he's this expert in cult deprogramming, and he's there to give a presentation and try and sell his book. So he does a presentation to a handful of people, gets like heckled and you know, ultimately beaten up during the presentation. And then somebody comes to approach him who was there and says, "Well, actually, you know, we don't know where else to go. Can you come and help us deprogram our daughter?" And he's not interested. He doesn't really care about what people think. Again, it's a bit of a theme, like we're saying, with a theme with some of these characters. He's as messed up as the characters in the serial killer movies that we've been talking about. You know, he's not trustworthy. You wouldn't call him a schemer, but he's, you know, you don't trust his expertise. You know, is he trying to con this thing, or, you know, does he have any, you know, credibility at all? You just don't really know. And I think I'll hand over to Will now to sort of pick up.
Well, you would if he'd seen that, unfortunately.
I haven't seen it.
Sorry, Will. I forgot you hadn't seen it. I'll hand you back to Mike then.
so you're right. This is a character who's sort of on his last legs, sort of professionally. And he's in a sort of very desperate situation, so he needs this job just for, you know, on a sort of total financial sort of level. But it's a way of him getting back in the game as well, you know, of proving that he can still do these things. And it is, you know, this starts off quite decent. You know, he seems to know what he's doing. But then the character that Mary Elizabeth Winstead plays. Just, you know, you can tell that slowly but surely there's these sort of mind games going on. Well, even though you're not sure what exactly is going on. And it gets really, really freaky, even though it's just like four people in two motel rooms for most of the film. Mm. You know, it's really weird to sort of say that, you know, the most sinister thing that happens is a door opening or a door locking, you know. Throughout the whole film, but it's just the way that it draws you into these conversations. When he starts getting it, talking about the cult, Foltz and its leader, Ira, and the camera starts off quite far away, and as the conversation's going, it's just inch by inch, just slowly sort of, you know, getting closer and closer and closer to them. It sort of really sort of draws you in that respect. I just love this, even though hardly anything happens in the film, really. It just does such a good job of portraying this broken person and, you know, this woman. I am sort of fascinated by these sort of cults. The podcast, Lud Podcast on the Left, did a really good one about Heaven's Gate. Mm-hmm. Heaven's Gate cults, and you know, which I previously only sort of, you know, I knew from a few sort of news articles and things, but they go into the whole history of it, and it goes back like 20-30 years, the way the cult sort of developed over time, and you sort of see how their ethos and their beliefs, you know, grew and things like that. So, I'm really intrigued by it. And yes, yeah, so that whole side of it I thought was really, really interesting. And then you get this doubleheader ending where it builds to, you know, as you know with cults, you know, they and like the army and things like that, where they sort of break down your character to you know, the lowest sort of common denominator sort of thing, and then try and build you back up. And kind of what happens in this. So, yeah. And then you get this sort of double whammy at the end, which I really enjoyed.
Yeah, I think there's definite comparisons that you could draw with 10 Cloverfield Lane, which Mary Elizabeth Winstead made after this one, I think, actually, a couple of years later. You know, that same kind of isolation, small cast, who's to be trusted, what's you know, what's really going on, you know, what do things mean, and that. So it's all, I think that because Cloverfield Lane was quite widely seen, I think, so if people enjoyed that Mary Elizabeth Winstead in that film, I think they would definitely be it would definitely be interesting for them to sort of see this. But, you know, even if people haven't seen film like that or whatever, I think this is definitely worth seeing. Mainly for Lila Lawser's performance and the sort of, it's like I say, the sort of indie sort of ponderousness of it. It's not up itself or anything. It's not like, you know, some of the accusations I could throw it to The Wire, you know, sort of overlong and, you know, just a bit too, you know, trying to be too smart and arty for its own good. This is very straightforward. It's comical. It's almost a comedy for at least the first half. I mean, in terms of a tonal shift, I wouldn't say Audition, but it's sort of heading in that direction. It sort of comes in, you're sort of establishing this sort of black comedy kind of world, and you know, things get real. You know, it gets really sort of very intense in that last act of the film.
Yeah, there is a very brutal murder at the end, even though, you know, it doesn't really sort of show you anything. You sort of hear and feel the impact of what's going on, and that, you know, that you can feel the intensity of what's going on as well. You know, it's sort of it's like, you know, taking the genie out of the bottle and not being able to put it back in, sort of thing. You know, it's like, well, you've unleashed this anguish from this person, and now they're taking it out on this other person. And it's pretty brutal.
Yeah, it's very well written, very well made. You know, and I think it's only about an hour and a half long, so it doesn't outstay its well.
Yeah, absolutely. I highly recommend it. We don't score the DTV throwbacks, but we will point you in the right direction. It's on Amazon Prime. There will be a link to the trailer in the footnotes. And that's the end of this week's show. So thank you to Will and Rich for joining me.
No problem at all. Happy to do it.
No problem. Pleasure.
Yeah, so we'll be putting links into the footnotes for the trailers and for the short shot. So be sure to check those out and tune in next time. Thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening to the DTV Digest. Let us know your thoughts in the comments and tune in again next time.